Thank you very much, especially for the organizers who invited me to this very nice place here. So I want to talk about Markov state models and coarse graining, which is something which is normally not mixed, but I hope that I can explain why it is interesting for you, the people who are mainly doing coarse graining. So let me start with an introduction to it, which makes clear where this Markov state models this concept comes from and how it has been stated and started. But it is later, I will later explain that I can hugely generalize what I'm doing here. So don't stay too close to this example. It's just something where I want to start it with. And if I start with this, then you see the motion of this tiny butane molecule with all the fluctuations and vibrations, but the overall rotation and translation have been skipped. And if we color this a little bit differently, then what you see that there are the states, the conformations of the molecule, or more exactly the metastable states of this system in which the dynamics runs for certain periods of time, and then there's a jump into another conformation. And in this special case, we just have these three ones there on the left, and what you see is that the dynamics on a long time scale, much longer than all the vibrations, is nicely described by the jumps between these three colored sets. And the sets somehow are sets in state space. They are shown here in Euclidean space, but in reality they are sets in state space, metastable sets of the system. So what we could do, we can construct, in this simple case, we can construct a Markov chain, which more or less tells us, given a certain time scale, in this sense, the simple time scale here, how frequent jumps between these states are. And then this description would allow us, on a longer time scale, to understand the effective dynamics of this object. So what I want to do is, I want to use this idea, understand what something, a material system is doing on a long time scale, understand it by constructing such a Markov chain. I want to develop this into a rather general concept. And in order to do this, I have to introduce some things. I'm a mathematician, so I will do this in a certain language. But at the end, we will come back to what you are normally doing, and then I will explain how these things are connected. Let me just for a second go back. This is a kind of coarse graining because it coarse grains state space into a lot of sets. And then there are jumps between these sets. And normally there will not only be jumps, but there will be transition times between these sets. Okay, you don't have coarse grain coordinates at the moment. You just have sets between the system jumps or between it which it relaxes. And later, just at the end of the talk, I will come back to the question, where are the coordinates? And then you will see that I can find them back in a certain way. Markov state models is something which has been built on this idea. There's very preliminary work which is already 15 years ago now, and then since about 5 years it has started to become real business with hundreds of articles. And the mathematical concept in the background is more or less the following. It is the transfer operator. And what does the transfer operator or propagator do? It is a linear operator. Let's say we have a dynamics, whatever this dynamics is. This dynamics samples a certain, I say, invariant measures, or what is a stationary ensemble. In this case, it can be, let's say, the Boltzmann distribution or something else. It is it runs in a certain state or phase space, doesn't matter. The dynamics is x, so x of t is running in time. And this is something in form of a unique object. So the dynamics samples, ergodically, this dynamics, this distribution. That's more or less the assumption. Then I introduce a scalar product, as you all know it from quantum mechanics, and this scalar product is in some sense special because it's weighted with the invariant measure. And if I do this, I get a transfer operator, which is a linear operator between two Hilbert spaces, okay, just function spaces. These spaces, in these spaces we have functions. And the operator does the following, which is illustrated here. It takes a function in the beginning at time zero, and then it simply tells us how the dynamics transports this function in time. So that's the same function transported by the dynamics some time t later. You all know this concept. If we transport probability distributions in time, then it's like a Fokker-Planck transport of a function in state space. This is more general. You can transport any function you want. And this transport is an operator, and you can write it down, and it looks complicated, but what it says at the end is that the transport of functions, like in Fokker-Planck theory, is always coming from a linear operator, whatever the dynamics is. It can be really nonlinear, even chaotic, very complicated, many, many time scales. Whatever it is, it can be as nonlinear as you want. The operator always is linear. And it's a Markov operator, so it preserves certain norms in this strange Hilbert space here. And what's interesting is that the largest eigenvalue always is this. This is connected to the invariant measure or the stationary distribution, like in Fokker-Planck's theory, because the stationary distribution under transport does not change, and this means it always must be an eigenvector for an eigenvalue 1 of the operator. But it is also the largest. All the other spectral elements are in the unit circle in the complex plane, the eigenvalues. And what is particular is that if the Markov process, so the dynamics, is reversible in a certain sense, the transfer operator is self-adjoint. And everything I will tell you in the following is for these self-adjoint cases, for reversible dynamics. We can generalize this for non-reversible cases, but that's a little bit complicated, and I skip it here. So that's the context I want to use. And that's the illustration why this is connected to meter stability. What you see here is the potential. Okay, for illustration, just 1D. It has four wells in this case. So let us assume that the average kinetic energy is small against the barriers in this potential. It means these wells are meter stable objects. In this case, the transition kernel of this dynamics would be something like this, which simply means if you start in one of the wells, then it runs around there for a long period of time before you cross the barrier into another part of the well. It's not necessary that it is a well. You just have to have the property that the dynamics runs around in a certain part of state space before it goes somewhere else. And if this is the case, then you will have eigenvalues. Some of them will be close to the eigenvalue, to the largest one, which is 1. And then there will be a gap, perhaps not. In most realistic cases, there is no gap. But let's assume for a second that there is one. And then you can compute the eigenvectors of these eigenvalues here. And from the eigenvectors, from their constants levels, you will find back the wells. You see that the levels of the eigenvectors more or less corresponds to the wells here. And this can be formally proven. So what you can really prove is that if you look at the structure of the eigenvalues, then the leading ones encode eigenvectors, and from the structure of the eigenvectors, you can find the sets, the wells in the system, which is in a very complicated system where you can understand, where you cannot understand the energy landscape. It might be interesting if we would be able to compute the eigenvectors, to learn this meter stable set from the eigenvectors. But in a large system, we will never be able to compute the eigenvectors. Nevertheless, I will use this structure, exploit it, and later explain how I can compute this information without knowing the eigenvectors. But the mathematical structure in the background always is there's a linear operator, so a very simple object. Its eigenvalue spectrum, if I compute the dominant one, it tells me everything about the meter stable sets in the system. And the smaller the eigenvalue is, the smaller is the time scale which is encoded by it, which I show here. So I have some nonlinear multiscale process, whatever it is. I get the linear transfer operator. I want to construct this Markov chain, which just jumps between some sets. So the nonlinear dynamics, which flips around between meter stable states, is just projected onto something which just jumps between sets, meter states of the system, between the meter stable sets of the system. And I have time scales of these jumps. So the jump behavior is encoded in the effective time scales of the dynamics. And these time scales are connected to the eigenvalues of the transfer operator. The largest eigenvalue, 1, is going to time scale infinity, which simply means ergodic behavior, convergence to the stationary distribution. And the longest time scales are coming from the eigenvalues which are closest to 1 of my system. This is as simple if the system is reversible, because then I have a self-adjoint operator and real valued eigenvalues, and everything is nice, like in quantum mechanics. So what comes in addition is if my sets, my meter stable sets, sorry for the mathematical notation, if it is, it forms a finite subdivision, which simply means my meter stable sets completely decompose state space. No overlap between them, and they completely decompose state space. If I have something like this, then the jumping behavior on a certain time scale, this is the probability that I start in one of the sets, and after some time I am in one of the other sets. So these are the transition probabilities between the sets. They can also be computed by scalar products of this damped eigenvalue, of the linear eigenvalue. And this means that what I have to compute here, the jump probabilities of my Markov chain, is just a Galerkin projection in my language of a transfer operator. So it just take the transfer operator, multiply it by left and right by certain ansatz functions, and if you take the right ones, then, so characteristic functions, these are characteristic functions of these sets, then it's just telling you the jump probabilities between these sets. And this I will use because it means that the way from here to there, it's just Galerkin projection. So it is a linear operator and then a projection of this operator to some low dimensional space. At the end of the talk, I will show you that coarse graining is the same. What you are trying to do is project a system with many variables to a system with less variables. And that's also a projection of something onto a linear submanifold or linear subspace. And you can put it into the same context as this one here. So I want to understand if this encodes the full dynamics of my full object, and this encodes the more or less an effective description in a lower dimensional space, how good is this? So how do I have to choose my basis functions in order to get the best approximation I can have here? And this means the best approximation of the kinetics, not of the statistics. In this case, the statistics comes by the way, how it is constructed. Now I want to have more, I want to have kinetics. And that we have to do one step in addition. If you look at this, then it's just the equilibrium distribution, in this case it's the free energy distribution in the torsion angle space alanine dipeptide. And it's just to illustrate that the blue simply means the value is zero, which means you see most of the space is empty. Nothing happens. So it doesn't make sense to have a full partition of state space. It's too large, you waste computing time for that. So we would be interested to avoid this fact of full partition. We would be interested to just identify the core of our meter stable sets. There where the probability distribution is high enough in order to have something which is statistically interesting. But this, in this case, you would have a dynamics, which is the green trajectory. Now, if it is long enough, then it will start in one of the meter stable sets, leave it, and then it can come back to here. But so, perhaps it also goes to another meter stable set, then does something here, and then so on. Because I assume ergodicity, every of these core sets will be met after some time. But when, that's not clear. In particular, it's not clear what you would say here. To which of the core sets would the state belong here? If we want to compute jump probabilities, then it's not so clear what we should say here. Where is the jump? When it leaves this set, or when it enters this set, or something in between? So that's not clear. It has to be cleared, and the solution, the math solution, the optimal solution, which I can tell you later, is this. It is the same idea that Ron Elber uses. You start in a set and you stay in a set until you meet to hit one of the other sets. So which means I would chop this trajectory into three pieces. The red one belongs to C1 as long as it has not entered another core set, which means if you are in this set and then you leave the set here, that doesn't matter as long as you haven't met this set. It still belongs to this core set, which means that it is the core set and all the neighborhood of it, the environment of the core set, is more or less containing into the same state. And if you do this, then you can prove that the following object is of interest in order to have a good construction. And that's the probability to be somewhere in X, so that's QIX, somewhere in X, while having visited the core set CI last. So this means I am coming from CI. That's exactly what I had. The red state here would be something where I came from C1 last. And all the states which are in the middle have more or less a probability to come from one of the other states of the core sets. And what is nice is that this It is something which is very similar to the committer function, which Christophe Delago had already this morning. For reversible dynamics, it's the same, more or less. It is given by a linear equation, which again involves this strange operator there. It's linear for a linear operator, and has some boundary conditions. I would never be able to really solve this, because that's a very high-dimensional operator, but it will later be important that it satisfies such an equation. And then with this, I can compute the jump behavior of my trajectory, of my real dynamics, in terms of this x hat, which now is I have chopped my trajectory into pieces, and the jump dynamics coming from the pieces, again, it can be written in this form, which simply again means it is a Galerkin projection of my operator, up to a new subspace, the subspace which is formed by these functions here. So I construct ansatz functions of my subspace according to the dynamical behavior of the system, according to how probable it is that if I am in a certain point, I came from one of the core sets. So in the neighborhood of a core set, this function will be almost one for this core set, and then it will decay to almost zero in the neighborhood of other core sets. So these ansatz functions have certain properties, and they allow to reformulate the eigenvalue problem again in form of an eigenvalue problem. So eigenvalues, the dominant ones of the original transfer operator, will again be eigenvalues of this new form of the operator where I just have these core sets, as in the case where I decompose the entire state space. And then I have something which is a mass statement, and that mass statement, the important thing here is these are the real eigenvalues of the full dynamics. So that's really encoding the real time scales in the full dynamics of my system. These are the eigenvalues. These are the eigenvalues of this coarse-grained matrix. So of this one here, which can be written as a coarse-graining or projection of the operator. In the more compact notation, it's this. And these eigenvalues, they can deviate a little bit from each other, or perhaps more, but I want to understand how much, because the error in these eigenvalues tell me how good I more or less can fit the timescales. So if these eigenvalues are very close, then I know that the timescales of the full dynamics are very nicely approximated by the timescales in my coarse-grained model. That's really kinetics. And I get a statement of the error in these eigenvalues, which is this. And the most important thing are these projection errors, the ones which I have written here. They contain the eigenvector, which is important here, and the projection on the subspace. So what I have here is I compare the projected eigenvector with the real eigenvector. And if there is no big difference, then I have a very small error, and the approximation of my kinetic timescales will be perfect. So this means, depending on which core sets I choose, I will get big or small error here. And what I want to do, I want to find the optimal core sets, which make these error as small as possible. Okay. So what is important here is that this statement here doesn't require any spectral gap. So you can have an almost continuous spectrum. The statement still is true. If there is a spectral gap, everything can be very nice, because then you can guarantee, you can construct a certain section of sets which definitely makes this error small. In cases where you don't have a gap, you can have problems. Normally you don't have. And there are systems where you have a very, very small delta, even if there's absolutely no spectral gap. So what is often in the literature, a spectral gap for constructions like this, a spectral gap is important, that's nonsense. You can definitely prove it's nonsense. So you don't ask for a spectral gap. And you don't need a Markov property. Even if the dynamics and jumps between these sets may be correlated, that doesn't matter for the statement. The kinetics still is correct on these long time scales. Yeah, that's also important. You don't need any statement of it has to be decorrelated or something like that. It's also nonsense. The only thing you have to have is that this object is small enough. Okay, there's one thing I do not, yeah? The whole thing is a Markov process, but a Markov process can still approximate something which is not really a Markov process. Yeah? It can have the same relaxation time scales, even if the underlying dynamics written in terms of these sets is not really Markovian. It is close to Markovian in the most cases, and that you can even prove, if there is a gap, you can prove it that it is very close to Markovian. But the only thing I want to have is that my Markov structure, the relaxation timescales in it, reproduce the relaxation timescales of the full dynamics. And there I don't need Markov structures. I just construct a Markov description of it. Let us accept this for a moment, because I come back to this later. Let us go to an example, which is just again one D for illustration purposes. And here I just have one well here, one well there, and a complicated landscape in between. Okay, you can make it much more complicated. But the process, the average energy is so small that it starts here and needs a very long period of time to leave this well, and then it has to travel here, and then sometimes it goes there. And in this case, you get these eigenvalues of the transfer operator. Okay, this one encodes the time scale which you need to go from here to there. This one here encodes the time scale to go from here to one of these two sets. And this is definitely far away from than that, which means that the time scale of this is much longer than the time scales encoded by that, and so on. And when I want only just to compute the jump behavior between these two dominant wells, then I can take these two core sets. The blue one will be the real eigenvector. The red dotted one will be the projection of this eigenvector onto this committer space, the one I have constructed by this probability distribution, this committer construction. And what you see, they are almost the same, which means that the error between the two is small, and the error in the eigenvalue is going with the square of this, which means that it is very, very small, which in this case means that the eigenvalue constructed by this is a very good approximation of that eigenvalue. So next question would be, what if I want to construct that? But first we have just this. What is interesting is that you can have the same statement for any eigenvalue of a transfer operator, even one which is not the longest timescale in the system, but somewhere in between, some intermediate timescale you are interested in. You can have the same statement, and it's exactly the same in the sense that you have your transfer operator, you have your projection, you have this projection error. That's the matrix which more or less, given the projection, which means this committer function given by the two core sets, the one which encodes this, and then you get this statement about the eigenvalue, which again means that it is a very good approximation of the timescale if this delta is a small error. So I have to care for a small error, even if I want to approximate a timescale somewhere in between. Sorry? Lambda 1 is always the eigenvalue which is closest to 1, but not 1, so the next one. So the general notation always is this, lambda 0 is 1, and then that's the next. And what you see here is, I have taken the same example as before. In this case, if I would take the middle part as an additional core set and take the two ones together as one core set, I would construct this eigenvalue from it, which is a very good, which is a very good approximation of the real second eigenvalue, and so on. So you can do this hierarchically. You identify core set by core set and timescale by timescale. And we have developed algorithms which do this, and you can, interestingly, you can define the core sets. You can find the optimal core sets for a given resolution, which means this is the projection error, which means a kind of discretization error. It depends on the choice of the core sets. And what comes in addition is a statistical error, which comes from the fact that you have to compute all the entries of your matrices by sampling the dynamics. And so you always have two sources of error, discretization error, statistical error. And we have to deal with both, but this can be done. What is more interesting, perhaps, is that this error, so this is always the delta here, the one which has to be small, this error can be, again, be estimated by mathematical techniques into something. So forget about this. What is important, this depends on the eigenvector still. I want to find something where it is small, so I have to know when it is small. This estimate tells me that I can estimate the smallness of this by other quantities. The most important is what is this. And I can give an estimate for this by this here. And this is telling me that's more or less the time I need if I start in between of the core sets, somewhere in the transition region. this time scale, if Z is in a transition radius, the expected time scale I need in order to return to one of the core sets. So that's the time I need to leave the transition region towards one of the core sets. If this is small, then my error is small. More importantly, this comes in addition, which means it is the time scale you need from the transition into the core sets divided by the time scale of switching between the core sets. And this, in many cases, can be made small, and you don't need the eigenvector to compute it. So you have something which is small if the process leaves the transition region quickly enough. It more or less measures the attractiveness of the core set and can be estimated by short trajectories which are starting just in between of the core sets. And this can be used in order to design an algorithmic strategy for finding the optimal core sets, even for systems of high dimensions. So we did this, for example, for protein folding. This is just a short example now. We took this pin WW protein, which in the folded structure has the centroid structure here. It is based on simulations with explicit water and several 10,000 of atoms, and you asked for the process of complete unfolding to the folded structure. So what is the process going on from here to there, the folding process, the time scales? And if you do this, then what we did is based on several hundred 100 nanosecond simulations of the protein distributed across state space in a very delicate and tricky way, so that the discretization error is getting smaller and smaller. So it is adaptive in this sense. It more or less tries also to minimize the sampling error in state space. And after the end, you come up with something like this. The numbers here are the committer values. All these pictures, more or less, are just pictures which indicate that behind this is a metastable set. So you see the folded structure, and the gray structure in the background, more or less, is the flexibility in this metastable structure. All of these metastable structures have metastability in the time scale of nanoseconds, at least. The numbers here are more or less the transition times between these structures. The small black values here are the uncertainties of these, which can be very large here, where the process is not known so precisely, but you don't need it in order to compute the folding time. But it's much more accurately known where it is very important. So you compute everything only to the accuracy which is needed. And this at the end ends with several hundred core sets, which more or less are these metastable sets which are represented by certain conformations of the system. And then they compute the committers by transition path theory and more or less can understand from this picture how the process from unfolded to folded really happens. The interesting thing is the time scale which you need in order to compute it is much, much longer than the folding time itself, because most computation time is computed in order to understand the transition times between neighboring conformations after some time. What is important is that you, if you analyze this in more detail, you see that it is something which goes into a misfolded state and then into the folded state, but that's not important here. What perhaps is interesting is this is the relaxation times coming from all the trajectories you have. The black ones are the relaxation times between the core sets, which are coming from the real MD trajectories we have computed, which is overall more than 30 microseconds. Sorry? So again, this is the probability to start in a certain set and then to leave this set, for example. While here you have the same probability, this is the folded state, this is the unfolded state, and so on. And this is done for several states of your system, also for switching between states. And the red one, the red line always is the line which comes out of the Markov model after convergence of the error. And the blue lines are the ones which come out of all the molecular dynamics trajectories, including the uncertainties which have been estimated by the estimator we used for the sampling error. Okay? That's the answer? Right. So, now I have to fulfill my promise and tell you how this relates to to coarse graining, and it is a coarse graining technique, but I don't have coordinates, at least not reduced coordinates. So coarse graining, in my perspective, is a projection of dynamics onto some low-dimensional object. It can be a subspace or some submanifold spanned by some coordinate map. The general questions always are, how do I identify a good subspace, find the right coarse graining coordinates? And then if I want to estimate the approximation quality, then there are lots of techniques which estimate the statistical properties. I'm more interested in the kinetic properties, so in the longest time scales, where the coarse-grained model still has the same time scales than the original model. And then there's the question how to get equations of motions if you went to certain time scales. What can I do here? I can use the same statement that I had, but in a different language. Sorry for the context, but it is a math statement which simply tells the following. Take your functions, which depend on the coordinates you choose, and some other coordinates, which are more or less orthogonal to it. In this case, it's easy. I assume that I simply can decompose state space and the subspace of the ones of interest and the other ones. But you can also do it for all coarse graining techniques you are normally using. It's the same statement then. And you just assume that the functions you are considering in my subspace now are the ones which are constant in one direction. In all the degrees of freedom you are no longer considering. Your low functions which vary in the coarse graining coordinates and are constant in all other directions in state space. And that's a subspace in your function space. And then you can consider the transfer operator projected to the subspace and can have exactly the same statement about the error as before. So what one has to do is find a good set of coordinates which minimizes this error. And surprisingly, this is possible because exactly the same theory applies. What you have to find is, you have to find this, I had an R of C, this quantity which tells you whether this error is small. This quantity didn't depend on the eigenvector itself. So we don't have to compute the eigenvectors. We can compute directly whether this is something small or not. Which means that if you give something which is a coarse grain coordinate set, I can, with a lot short trajectory calculations, I can tell you whether this error is small or not. And if it is small, it guarantees that the longest timescales in your system are correctly reproduced or not. At the moment, I cannot solve the problem how to compute the right coarse-graining subspace. We are working on this. At the moment, we can simply, if you give me a coarse-graining set, I can compute this error and can tell you whether it's small or not. And I'm back to this question set here. What do I have? I use this transfer operator setting, which means that I don't have to have the equations of motions in terms of the coordinates. I just need the subspace. And then it's just playing around with a linear transfer operator, calculating certain errors from linear projections. And this tells us something about the longest time scales in the system. It does not necessarily tell you about all the statistical properties you want. So it's something else than we have seen in all the talks before. But this statement, and there are lots of generalizations of it, means that for what you are trying to do, I see it. Oh, my question generally is, how can I be certain that a certain coarse graining strategy really has the same kinetic properties than for the system than the original one also? And in some sense, that is, I believe that it can be a kind of background theory for this question. Thank you very much for your attention.
So a few minutes for questions.
So when you assign configurations that are outside the core sets to the core set that is visited last, you said that this is optimal in some sense. Can you tell me how?
It's the only, you can prove that it is the only way to assign this that satisfies the property that it later again is a projection on a subspace. Okay? All other ways to assign a state which is in between. Okay, you can also have the other way around. What is the next set which is hit, which in the reversible case is the same? but all other things introduce problems with this Markov property. So that's the cleanest way you can define it in mathematical terms. So it's optimal in the sense of how close is what you define to, again, a linear problem. It's not optimal in the sense of it is the best you can do in terms of some physical properties. Okay?
So, on the same question, doesn't it violate time reversal?
Sorry?
Doesn't this assignment violate time reversal symmetry? If you have a trajectory backwards, it will be assigned to a different set.
Yeah, right. I said it in the beginning. In this presentation, I more or less said that I assume that the dynamics is reversible. If the system is not reversible, you have to do a different way to define it, because then you have to distinguish between the forward and the backward process, and the forward and backward committers are not the same. Or more or less, they are not connected by one is one minus the other.
I'm assuming a time reversible system, your
right, but if you assume that your sampling scheme is ergodic enough, so a sample is a stationary measure, you will come up with the same statistical and kinetic properties because of the assumed reversibility. Yeah, but if you don't want to assume this, the whole theory is there for irreversible processes also. It doesn't change a lot, but it looks a little bit more difficult.
So I wonder whether I understand you correctly. You're saying that if you have a very complicated high-dimensional microscopic dynamics, and if for whatever reason that seems to be hopping between a very limited set of states, then you can find these states in a sort of simple way. But for coarse grain, the problem is, of course, also if I now only have access to these states and I want to now find a new dynamics based only on these limited, it's not obvious how I would find that dynamics, is that right?
Right, completely right.
Okay.
So the point is, all of this works in this transfer operator setting, which is a setting which just tells you how to move functions. It doesn't tell you how the microdynamics is, or the CG dynamics. If you want to do this, then you have to do this projection of the transfer operator, which is the projection of the generator of your Fokker-Planck system, for example. And then you are back into 20-Maury theory, like there, for example, in the DPD field, there are these 20-Maury approaches in order to compute the effective dynamics. You can do it, but there are lots of problems connected to it. At the moment, we are in the process of reformulating this theory with this errors attached in order to get a more robust version of this 20-Maury approach. But I cannot guarantee it at the moment. The thing is aiming at finding the right subspace, not at finding the equations of motion, not in general. Right. I can give you that, but I don't, at the moment, I cannot give you the equations of motions in this coordinates.
Maybe this is a follow-up question. So you can, by this method, you can write down the transition matrix. You can make Markovian model. You can construct, I believe. Now, so you want to transform that to some equation of motion? What you are aiming at? So
I take the full dynamics. And then I construct some coarse grain coordinates and project the dynamics on this. But I'm not looking for the equations of motion, but just for whether functions are transported in the right way.
Yeah.
And what I can measure is whether this is the case or not. And this implies whether the long time scales of your coarse graining scheme are more or less very similar to the long time scales of your full dynamics. That's the question I can answer. But it's not constructive in a way that I can also cook up the right equations of motions in your coarse grading coordinates. I can answer how large is the kinetic error of your coarse grading scheme. And if for certain cases, I can even based on many, many trajectories, I can construct good coarse graining coordinates. But I cannot give you equations of motions in these coordinates.
You think that you can eventually derive, so it's possible to derive something, I'm so sorry. So you can construct some time evolution equation for the probability distribution function for the coarse grain, for these metastable states, I believe.
Yeah.
But so do we have to obtain this equation motion? Do we have to go further? Isn't that
sure,
enough?
Sure, that's what we are working on, but the problems involved in this are already known from this all the work in the context of Zwanzig-Maury approaches. It is very difficult to derive the right equations of motions without doing all the things we have seen today. So trying to find the optimal equations of motion by fitting the right potentials, like in inverse Monte Carlo or in this relative entropy optimization thing. So this, if I want to do this in a constructive way, it can be very, very difficult. And at the moment, I cannot offer a solution to this. So I can offer to estimate the approximation quality of a coarse graining scheme. But at the moment, I would use other techniques to find equations of motions in these coordinates.
Two questions, actually. The first, from a practical point of view, I mean, you're determining this transition matrix from short trajectory simulations, and then from that you get the longest time scale in the system. So how good a statistics do you need to get this reliably?
This I cannot answer a priori.
Yeah.
So I can. What we are doing is we have a certain scheme where we have to start trajectories, which is mainly based on a rough overlook over the landscape of your system. Then you start lots of trajectories, which more or less leads you to a first very coarse Markov state model, where the discretization error is this and this, and the statistical error is huge. And then you start trajectories wherever it is needed in order to decrease the sampling error of your system. And this is what I call adaptive. So you have to reduce your error, and you start this in a local sense. You do it where it is necessary. There where you have the largest error, you start trajectories. So you can estimate the largest error, start trajectories there, and hope that these trajectories behave in a way which reduce your error. They mostly do, but not always. So you have to start trajectories, and after some time it starts to converge. And then after some time you know the uncertainties of your, let's say, transition rates, and depending on what you want to compute, for example, the folding rate of a protein, you have to do so and so much accuracy in certain parts of state space. And you can compute also, if you want, you can compute transition rates between neighboring metastable sets, for example, with transition path sampling or so. You have all the techniques available to do these calculations if you want it. But you have to reduce the uncertainty of every entry in your matrix to a certain extent in order to get good approximation properties for the quantity you want. Yeah?
Okay, and another question just out of curiosity. Now assume you have a situation where the long time behavior is algebraically decaying, so your long time scale is actually infinity. How would that show up in this approach?
Infinity is just the convergence to the equilibrium distribution, but it's obvious for everyone in the field. If you have a system, you can have timescales which are so long that you will never be able to approximate this. But I have this statement, and this statement simply tells you you can also approximate all timescales which are intermediate. So you can perhaps have a protein which is folding on minute timescales. You have absolutely no hope to ever compute this, but you still can approximate partial folding of sign chains or something like this on the right time scale if you do the right construction. And this is what we also have done. So it's not always the very long time scales, but at the moment I would say it's the time scales you can access in your system, which is by short trajectories and, like, for example, using folding at home or something like this, you can have 100,000 trajectories And with this, the total length of it is in the milliseconds even. So this is the time scale we can access at the moment, but not much longer. So everything which is longer in a given system will never converge. You can start the process, but it will never converge, or at least not in a reasonable time.
I just have a quick question about your WW domain folding. So am I correct in saying that you're already projecting out also all the water degrees of freedom when you look at this, or are you including them?
No, it's all atomistic detail for the protein and the explicit water.
So when you define your states that you're looking at transitions
between. That's the point. They are not defined in terms of some reaction coordinates or something like this. They are just subsets in state space.
Okay, so it includes
those. And they
are
implicitly defined. So we cannot tell you, we can give you all the states which have been sampled, which lie in this set. But we cannot tell you it is this and that and this and that coordinates. It's not constructive in this sense. It simply sampled it. And what you have is your conformation is a subset of all the states which have been visited, which belong to the subset.
Okay. I'll have to think about it a little more.
Okay, so I think just to remain on schedule, we should take further discussion offline. But thank you very much for a very interesting talk.